Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Glad you're with me today. We've got a great second hour coming up. Ryan T. Anderson is going to be with us, as is Bruce Ashford. I've been teasing Bruce that he should try to see what it's like to be an amateur radio host for a segment. So I'm going to sort of let him conduct some of the interview this morning, and I'm going to be the moderator. I will jump in when need be, but Bruce is so familiar with the subject we're going to talk about. Ryan T. Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, has gotten all kinds of attention, and we're going to discuss his book with him and Bruce. So what a great conversation we're going to have. And then a little bit later in the hour, Chris Martin's with us, the millennial evangelical. So that will be how we're going to spend this hour. I know this is we're going to jump into our conversation ASAP, so let's get them both on the line. Let's take a very short break, and when we return, Ryan T. Anderson and Bruce Ashford back in a minute. It is 6 minutes after the hour. My guest, Ryan T. Anderson, graduated with honors from Princeton and the University of Notre Dame. He is the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. His research has been cited by two U.S. Supreme Court justices. How cool is that? Also, our friend and frequent guest, Bruce Ashford, is with us as well. He's the provost of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
You bet. So, Bruce, I know you've always wanted to see what it's like to be a radio host, and you know so much about this topic, and you know Ryan a little bit. So, I'm going to go get some coffee. I've got a pager. If they need me, they're gonna come get me. Go ahead, Bruce.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Bill, for letting us come on the show. So, for those of you out there in radio land, Ryan T. Anderson, if you don't know him already, has published a number of significant books on big topics. 2012, published a book entitled What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. So he defends a historic traditional view of marriage. Then in 2015, published Truth Overruled, Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, which sort of interprets what we're going to have to deal with in the aftermath of Obergefell v. Hodges. And then recently has published When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. You can find it on Amazon very quickly. It's only a few weeks old. It's gotten a ton of attention and attracted some haters and is driving the national conversation right now. So, Ryan, can you tell us, what motivated you to write the book and what has the early response been?
Sure. I mean, so some of the initial motivation was what was taking place in that last year of the Obama administration, because as soon as the activists on the left had successfully redefined marriage, they pivoted from the LGB to the T part of the acronym, and they started redefining sex and gender. And so we got those mandates from the Obama administration, the Dear Colleague letter, which was changing school bathroom, locker room, shower policies all across the country. But then as I started digging deeper into this, I realized this is not just a public policy question or a legal question. There are human lives at stake. And it was some of the testimonies from people who had transitioned and then detransitioned that really struck me and really kind of convicted me that I had to do something a little bit larger on this issue. I had to help people see what was at stake, not just in terms of like privacy or safety in the locker room, but what was at stake in terms of human nature and the human costs of getting human nature wrong.
Yeah, so, you know, I've noticed, follow you on Twitter, and you've made some new friends since you wrote this book. You've got some activists that are trolling you and sort of coming after you. And it seems like they're really bothered, I think, specifically by the message from many of the detransitioners. So can you tell us a little bit about the activists and then distinguish them from the detransitioners? Seems like a very, very
sure,
different
yeah.
View on things.
Yeah, and this is actually important just to distinguish the activists from everyone else. People who suffer from gender dysphoria, people who identify as transgender, the vast majority of these people, they're not activists of any sort. They're simply trying to do the best they can under very trying circumstances. Imagine feeling so uncomfortable in your own body that you would contemplate having surgery to amputate certain parts of your body and to try to transition to the opposite sex. These people are struggling, they're suffering. They deserve our compassion and a charitable response. Put them on one side of the ledger. On the other side of the ledger, you have activists who want to claim that the truth about the human person is that sex is merely assigned at birth, and that the truth about modern medicine is that sex can be reassigned through hormonal and surgical procedures, and that the truth of the human person is that a boy can be trapped in a girl's body or a girl can be trapped in a boy's body. Those are ideological claims. And so I spent a lot of time in the book addressing the activists and the ideologues who are simply making claims about the human person that are false. And then the third group of people you mentioned are the people who transitioned, thinking that it would bring them the wholeness and the happiness that they were seeking, and then 5 or 10 years later detransitioned because it didn't bring them that wholeness. And their stories are heartbreaking because so many common themes emerge. That modern medicine never really explored with them the possible causes of their gender dysphoria or discussed alternative treatments. Many of them now regret that they lost their fertility, that they lost their voice. Some of them that had mastectomies, that they have a scarred chest area. Many of them who transitioned when they were in high school now later in life look back and say, we were much too young to be making such life-altering decisions. When we were teenagers, why didn't anyone kind of counsel us to slow down? And so, you know, part of what prompted me to this was precisely to say, all right, we need to slow down and have the conversation we're having right now.
You know, I remember the, I think it was the Telegraph published a few months ago a story about a genital reconstructive surgeon, Miroslav Georgievic, who came out and said that basically seeing a spike in gender reversal surgeries, I think for the very reasons you're mentioning, and that these people who are coming back are experiencing crippling levels of depression, in many instances suicidal thoughts. I think it just reminds us that we can't contradict reality forever with impunity, that reality bites back. And so I want to ask you, define reality for us for a minute. What is it that makes a man and a woman a woman?
Oh, sure. I mean, so to a certain extent, sex is a physical, bodily reality. And then gender is the way in which we give expression to that physical, biological reality. So there is something of a distinction between sex and gender, but gender isn't merely a social construct. It's not something we construct out of whole cloth from nothing. It's the way that we give expression to our sexed bodies. And our sexed bodies are based upon the organization of our body for sexual reproduction, which sounds like a mouthful, but it's something that, you know, more or less everyone readily can recognize when they walk down the street and they see someone. They can say, that's a boy, that's a girl, that's a man, that's a woman, so much so that it's not merely, quote, assigned at birth, but sometime around week 20, expectant parents they find out the sex of their child through a grainy ultrasound image. The ultrasound technician can discern the reality of that child's body as male or female. This starts at conception. It starts with the chromosomes that we inherit from our parents when we're conceived, either an XX or an XY, if all goes well. And then that'll then influence the development of certain sexual organs, which then produce certain sexual hormones. And then that whole trajectory is taking place in utero to organize our bodies either along the male trajectory or a female trajectory.
So I'm curious, in American society, when did we really start to see people separating sex from gender? Was there a moment in our cultural life?
This takes place about two generations ago, in the 50s and the 60s. And what's so fascinating here, and I go through some of this history in the book just to show how contradictory some of the current activists are. Because initially, the word gender was developed in contradistinction to sex. The radical feminists in the 50s and the 60s wanted to say, look, sex is merely a biological given, but gender is a social construct. And so we're merely constructing these differences between boys and girls in terms of who likes blue and who likes pink, who likes dolls and who likes trucks. That's all a social construct. And so we can refashion the social construct. Now we have activists saying that gender identity determines someone's sex. And so if you're a boy who likes the color pink, you're a boy who likes to play with dolls, you're a boy who, quote, identifies as a girl, that makes you a girl. And so it's very interesting that within the course of two generations, we've gone from trying to distance ourselves from certain sex stereotypes to reifying them and to actually saying that these stereotypes are now what determine our sex identity.
Gentlemen, if I could just jump in for a minute, I just have to say my ratings just went up 28%, largely due to the fact I've stopped talking. So, Bruce, you're doing a great job. I still hope I get my stipend today because you're knocking it out of the park. And, Ryan, you're awesome. So let me take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford and Dr. Ryan T. Anderson. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the program, 18 minutes after the hour. We're speaking to Ryan T. Anderson, his book, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Movement. And he is being interviewed by Dr. Bruce Ashford, our friend. And he's asking McLaughlin Group-style questions and doing an awesome job. So let's resume the conversation, gentlemen.
All right, great. Thank you. So we're talking about Ryan T. Anderson's new book, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. It's a great book, substantive, well-researched, but lucidly written. So it's the kind of book that you could buy for, you know, an everyday American if they're interested in the topic. And we've so far we've talked a little bit about the difference between transgender activists and people who are just experiencing gender dysphoria. They're confused about their body and their identity. And we've talked a little bit about biological reality, what makes a man and a woman and a woman. I want to turn now to the topic of kind of chapters 6 and 7 in the book and ask Ryan, you know, what are some of the specific negative consequences that come about when transgender ideology is kind of weaponized to convince people to do sex reassignment surgery, childhood hormonal therapy, like you mentioned earlier on the show? I mean, there's our children who are being encouraged, in some cases even coerced, to switch their gender identity when they're 6, 8, 10, 12 years old. So what are some of the negatives that happen? I don't think people understand this.
Oh, sure. So let's start by just discussing what the standard of care is that the gender experts have promulgated. They say that for a child who experiences a gender identity conflict, a child with gender dysphoria, as young as age 2 or 3 or 4, that child should first socially transition. So parents should give a child a new name, a new pronoun, a new wardrobe, new bathrooms and locker rooms. At age 10, the child should be placed on puberty-blocking drugs to prevent that child from going through puberty in the, quote, wrong body. At age 14, 15, and 16, boys should be given estrogen to feminize their bodies. Girls should be given testosterone to masculinize their bodies. And then at age 18, you can have surgery to try to transition your body. What are some of the consequences of this? Well, what we know is that normally 80 to 95% of children with gender dysphoria will naturally grow out of it. They'll come to re-identify with their body if they're simply given the time and the space to continue normal development. But in one of the clinics that pioneered this treatment protocol, this four-step protocol I just mentioned, 100% of the children placed on puberty-blocking drugs persisted in their transgender identity. And so this has made several therapists caution that this may be a self-reinforcing protocol, that you may very well be locking in a transgender identity by encouraging a young child to transition and then blocking puberty, which may very well be one of the developmental mechanisms that helps a child grow out of their gender identity conflicted stage. Beyond the long-term costs here, we now know that 41% of people who identify as transgender attempt suicide at some point in their lives. People who have had sex reassignment surgery are 19 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population. These hormonal and surgical procedures will render the individual infertile. Frequently, in terms of children, we have no idea what the long-term consequences are because there have been no studies on what the long-term outcomes are of blocking puberty for a child and then administering cross-sex hormones. There are concerns, and I think very valid concerns, about what it will do to height, to weight, to bone density, to organ development. We're conducting an experiment on minors by preventing them from going through their normal biological development, and we have no idea what that will do to a body to not allow it to mature.
Yeah, so, you know, that's very helpful. And I think one question that a lot of us have centers on public policy. How do we create public policy that respects people who are experiencing gender dysphoria, but does not push a transgender ideology on society? So the 2016 HHS mandate would have forced all of the Affordable Care Act health care plans to cover gender reassignment surgeries and therapies, and it would have coerced medical practitioners to perform them. And so in May, I think it was, on the day that the HHS regulation was finalized, you mentioned in your book that the Departments of Justice and Education sent a letter out to public schools, a top-down letter on gender identity, that used a kind of sleight of hand and reinterpreted the word sex to mean gender identity. And so this is just, I think, the beginning of what could be a lot of further sleight of hand and problems that are caused.
Oh, of course.
Can you begin to work through some of the public policy concerns?
Yeah. I mean, I had joked at one point that the transgender mandate was the Obamacare contraception mandate on steroids because it would require both sex steroids, so you'd have to do estrogen and testosterone therapy for patients, but then it also required surgery. So for listeners, to think back to the Little Sisters of the Poor and Wheaton College and Hobby Lobby and all of the people who spent five or more years in federal court trying to prevent the Obama administration from making them provide morally objectionable health insurance, whether it was abortion coverage or contraceptive coverage. Now we had the Obama administration in its last year in office saying healthcare plans had to cover sex reassignment procedures, and even more radically, physicians had to perform them. So what this said is that if you were an endocrinologist and you do testosterone therapy for men with low testosterone, you would have to do testosterone therapy for women who want to identify as men. If you're a surgeon and you perform hysterectomies and mastectomies on women with cancer, you would have to perform those same surgeries on women who want to identify as men. There were no religious liberty exemptions. There were no conscience protections. There were no best medical judgment considerations. Many physicians, regardless of religion or morality, simply think this is bad medicine, that the proper response to gender dysphoria is a form of mental health care, psychotherapy, therapy addressed at the mind, not at the body. And they were being told that as a condition of their medical practice, that they would have to perform these treatments on people with gender dysphoria, or else they would be guilty of discrimination. And of course, that's what's then being used in the school context to redo the bathrooms, the locker rooms, the showers, the sports teams. What we need to do here is find a way of respecting people who are struggling with their gender identity while also respecting the interests, the rights, the privacy of everyone else. And so in the school context, what I've suggested is we can create single occupancy facilities for anyone who desires additional privacy, but we don't have to force a boy who identifies as a girl into the boys' room nor do we have to allow him into the girls' room. We can accommodate him with a single occupancy facility.
Yeah, it seems like there's simple solutions to some of these cases that seem to be so complicated. Can you talk with us a little bit about, and I just want to mention, this is what happens in society when we absolutize a conception of liberty that means freedom from all restraints, right? Freedom from without a freedom for. And we're going to see a lot more of these problems. Can you talk to us about privacy concerns, safety concerns, and equality concerns?
Sure. So the privacy concern here, it's the reason we have separate facilities for men and women in the first place is that most women don't want to be seen or see someone else in a state of undress. So a woman, when she's in a state of undress, most of them don't want to be seen by you and me, and they don't want to see you and me when we're in a state of undress. And so we provide separate facilities for men and women in locker rooms, in bathrooms, shower facilities, precisely to have privacy with respect to our bodies. And so if you're a man with all the standard male parts, but you identify as a woman, and you enter into that women's locker room, that shower facility, it's understandable why the women who identify as women feel uncomfortable, why it would violate their privacy concerns for them to be seen by you or for them to see you in a state of undress. The safety concern is slightly different. It's not so much that people who identify as transgender will somehow be violating the safety of women. It's that predators will, and that predators will use one of these gender identity laws to gain access to victims. And we saw in just the months after Target changed its fitting room policy, several men were caught disguised as women going into the women's facilities. And so that's the safety concern. And I quote an FBI sex crimes expert and the sheriff that governs his jurisdiction includes the University of Tennessee. So he has experience with sex crimes at the college level. And both the FBI agent and the sheriff say, this is where lots of sex crimes take place. It's in these intimate facilities. And if we don't have a clear rule of who's supposed to be there and who's not, it's the perverts and the predators who are going to be abusing this. And then lastly is the equality rule. We've already had girls lose athletic competitions to boys who identify as girls or to girls who identify as boys and are taking testosterone, which normally would be a performance-enhancing drug. In each case, these girls didn't have an equal playing field.
This is hard to admit, but this has been one of the most interesting interviews on my show. And all I did was sit and drink coffee. Nice job, Ryan. And thank you, Bruce,
thank you for putting
this together. And this has been a lot of fun. Ryan's book, When Harry Became Sally, is available on Amazon.com. Head over. And Bruce, thanks again for being on the show. And Ryan, have a great day.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Bill.
You bet. It's half past the hour. We'll take a short break, and we'll go right to news. Minutes until the top of the hour. What a great hour we're having today. More to come with Chris Martin in just a minute. But until then, Ray Hollenbach, who's a pastor and author, says it can be difficult to extend grace to other people. But he encourages us to release those people to God and trust that through his grace, he is working on them.
So this is a serious question that's got really deep roots. And that is that if I preach grace, if I lead a small group or a women's Bible study, or if I'm a pastor in the pulpit, if I preach grace, am I telling people that their actions don't matter? But of course our actions matter. And in fact, grace becomes the most effective way for transformation. And you see, that's part of why I wrote the book. I wanted people to see the connection between grace and maturity, between grace and discipleship. I wanted to give people the practical hope that there really is grace for change. If we are a Christian leader in any setting, we have to trust that the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men. And the wisdom of men tends towards legalism. Don't do that. Be sure to do this. And always do this. But it's the foolishness of God in things like the gospel and in preaching and in the message of grace that actually brings the most effective hope for change.
If you want to hear that full interview from Ray Hollenbach, head over to myfaithradio.com. What a great website that is. If you've not been recently, check it out. It's so easy to use. They've got a big search engine. You type in Ray Hollenbach with your two fingers. If you type the way I type, maybe it'll take you 8 to 12 seconds, maybe longer. And you just type it in, and there it is. You'll get that whole interview. We're going to take a little break, and then Chris Martin's with us.
When they say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, they aren't necessarily referring to personality types. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Just because a child shares your last name and reflects your facial features doesn't mean they have a similar personality type. You may be calm, cool, and collected, while your son is boisterous in the life of the party. You might be into sports, while your daughter would rather play clarinet in the band. Neither personality is bad. It just takes extra effort on your part to accept your child as he is. When it comes to the apple falling far from the tree, celebrate the differences in your kids.
Having trouble parenting your teen in today's rapidly changing culture? Mark Gregston can help. Get instant access to Mark's new free parenting course online at freeparentingcourse.com.
We are back with 22 minutes until the top of the hour. Chris Martin, you may know him as the Millennial Evangelical. You can go to millennialevangelical.com. He's also at Lifeway Research and is my frequent guest on the show and a big baseball fan. He loves the Cubs, and baseball season is just around the corner. So if you're like me, Chris, you're getting excited.
I am. And in fact, you know, it's been pretty chilly this week in Nashville, but this weekend, yesterday it was like 72.
Nice.
Today it's supposed to be like 65. And every time we get, you know, kind of a taste of spring a little bit early, I especially get a little bit more excited for baseball season because and now that daylight savings time has happened,
I know.
You know, it's lighter later. And so it's starting to feel a little bit more like summer, and I'm really excited.
And didn't you and your bride just go to Disneyland? Didn't you take a vacation?
Yeah, we went to Disney World in Florida.
Yeah.
And it was like we're celebrating our fifth anniversary.
Nice.
Later this year in June. And so we asked our friends, hey, when's the best time to go to Disney World? Like, when's it not very busy? And they said end of February, it tends to be a good time. It's also my wife's birthday. So
nice.
We were like, hey, let's do it. Let's celebrate our fifth anniversary early, celebrate your birthday, and go to the quote unquote happiest place on earth. So it was a great time.
Yeah. Was it happy and was it super expensive?
It was happy, and it was pretty expensive, but not as bad as I felt like everyone hyped it up to me. But then again,
okay.
We don't have kids.
Oh, that's true.
So when you have kids, it makes things a little bit more expensive.
Yeah, and who watched the puppy?
We had friends come and hang out at the house and kind of house sit and puppy sit. It was great. They did a great job.
Nice. All right, let's talk about something that we see more and more on the internet, which is so disturbing. It's people that want a little bit of internet fame, and this happens often with younger people in particular. But there was a stunt that went bad and it actually took place in Minnesota, where a woman and her boyfriend were going to pull off a stunt where she was going to shoot him in the chest with a real gun, but the book that he was holding in front of him was going to stop the bullet. Is that right?
That's the stunt. It's not right, but it is correct. That's the stunt. So on YouTube, now to give you and your listeners a little bit of context, what this couple, this boyfriend, girlfriend were doing obviously was silly and really ignorant and not, they shouldn't have been doing it. It was foolish, but it's not as crazy as you might think. When you understand YouTube culture, and for a long time, I just saw YouTube as a place you posted video to eventually share on Facebook or something else.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of saw it as a place where that hosted video on the internet. But YouTube really has its own culture. YouTube really has its own social media culture, like Twitter or Facebook or any other social media platform. And one of the big kind of hallmarks of YouTube culture is like prank culture or stunt culture. And so, you know, if you were to think of YouTube like a television channel, it's like the biggest TV channel in the world. One of the most popular genres of content on YouTube is prank slash crazy stunt genre.
Mm-hmm.
And so this couple was really just trying to kind of make a name for themselves in that genre. I mean, people do stuff as foolish as this pretty often and don't kill themselves doing it. Unfortunately, this couple had a bad thing happen. So the boyfriend convinced the girlfriend that it would be safe. And so he kind of, from what I understand, kind of coerced her into doing it or prodded her into taking part in the stunt. And he said, "Hey, I'm going to hold this really thick book in front of me, and you're going to take this, you know, 50 caliber pistol, like a huge pistol, and shoot me through the book, or hopefully not through the book, from some number of feet away. And then we're going to post it on YouTube and we're going to get famous." That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in June, I think. And so I remember hearing about it when it happened, and he died because the book, however thick the book was, could not stop a 50 caliber pistol bullet, which most people who know guns probably would say, of course not. But this guy just didn't understand that the pistol he was handling, or that his girlfriend was handling, I suppose, isn't like your normal kind of concealed carry pistol.
Mm-hmm.
And so a terrible thing happened. And this is just – honestly, this is the culture of YouTube. This is why YouTube is having a lot of problems right now. Not because people are killing each other for trying to get views. Not that. Most people aren't going to that length. But YouTube is really rewarding videos that just get eyeballs. YouTube has very little moral compass. Now they're having to develop one because now that advertising has become so much more popular on YouTube, and big name advertisers, Pepsi, T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, all these, a ton of Fortune 500 and top 10 kind of companies are advertising on YouTube because advertisers are always going after that emerging young people demographic, and YouTube is the platform that has their most attention right now, more than TV by a long shot. And so YouTube is in a situation where they're having to please creators. So people like this, or hopefully most of them being a little bit wiser than these folks, they're having to please creators by creating rules and kind of fences that don't limit their creativity. But then at the same time, they have to please advertisers who don't want their ads running in front of certain types of content. And so YouTube's kind of in a pickle where they're having to serve – honestly, they're having to serve two masters whose values are often completely different. YouTubers the creators on YouTube are often very raw. There are a few I've done a lot of research on this and have found very few explicitly Christian YouTubers. There are a lot of famous Christian YouTubers, but most of them aren't creating content that's explicitly Christian. And so YouTube culture is pretty crass sometimes. It's pretty just raw. People are just sharing real lives. They're not trying to censor themselves much. The problem is advertisers want people to censor themselves like they're on network TV.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas YouTube is maybe more HBO culture rather than – not in terms of like nudity and all that. Like that YouTube has rules in place for that. But it's very language-wise and all of that. It's more raw. Advertisers don't like that. But what you get is when YouTube rewards craziness, basically the crazier stunt you do on YouTube, the more views you're going to get.
Mm.
When YouTube – as long as YouTube has that idea and that culture – we might see more situations like this.
Chris, yeah, this YouTube culture reminds me of a line that Matt Smethurst said from the Gospel Coalition. He said, "Satan doesn't whisper, 'Believe in me.' He whispers, 'Believe in yourself.'" So you start doing really stupid things like that. Let me take a break. When we come back, more with Chris Martin, 14 minutes until the top of the hour. It is 12 minutes till the top of the hour, and of course tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, which makes today March 16th. That would make it 3/16/18. And think of John 3:16, today, for God so loved the world, he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life, or eternal life, whatever version you read. All right. Chris, as we talk about the YouTube culture, there is a story I heard of a mother who was doing this little video of her 8-year-old son, and the 8-year-old son says, "Mom, is this YouTube worthy?" Because they, yeah, that 8-year-old had an awareness of how good you need your YouTube videos to be, so it gets a lot of likes.
Oh yeah, man, I've run into so many and heard so many stories of 6-year-old kids, 7-year-old kids who want to be YouTubers. Like, you know, like when I was that age, I wanted to be a baseball player or whatever.
Right.
And they're that age and they want to be a YouTuber.
Because
I mean,
crazy.
It's, you know, in their eyes, because they watch these folks all the time. They, you know, they're like their TV stars, kind of. And, you know, like I said, there are some crude folks on YouTube. There are some crass folks on YouTube. But there are a lot of people who make really great content for kids. Now, mm-hmm. I don't have any children yet, and this is a conversation and a situation that I'm going to have to deal with once I have a child. You know, screen time is a big thing parents need to be aware of, and how much time they let their kids watch YouTube or TV or whatever else. But there are some great, you know, from my experience just kind of poking around the platform a little bit, there are some great, you know, channels that make interesting content for kids or just content that's, you know, clean and things like YouTube has done historically a pretty good job of kind of age gating a certain subset of their platform for kids. And so, yeah, it's funny, man. It's little kids. It's their TV. And so it's going to be, you know, to some extent, radio has been disrupted by the internet. To some extent, you know, all kinds of things have been disrupted by the internet, retail stores, all kinds of things. And I think TV has been disrupted a bit. But I think as YouTube continues to, you know, YouTube is popular among people my age. I'm 27. YouTube's popular among people my age. It is far more popular among people in high school and younger, especially younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's going to be interesting to me as we kind of proceed, assuming YouTube does not implode, which, hey, anything is possible. Assuming YouTube doesn't implode, I'm interested to see how it affects, you know, TV moving forward. Now, I mean, now YouTube has YouTube TV where you can pay, I think it's like $30 a month, and get a lot of what your cable provider offers. You're just getting it over the internet and provided by YouTube instead of through your cable provider.
Wow.
And so yeah, I mean, you can get ESPN and all kinds of other channels that a lot of people, that's why they subscribe to cable or whatever. I don't do cable, so I'm not sure. But so yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But the instance you talked about, you know, a young kid saying, "Hey, Mom, is this YouTube worthy?" Or, you know, I know a couple friends of mine who have kids. Their kids, you know, like ask their mom if they can carry around their phone and like pretend like they're vlogging, you know, like recording video of mm-hmm. just their everyday life because they watch that stuff all the time. It's kind of it's funny. It borders on sad, but I think it is kind of interesting to see.
All right, Chris. Some people want to do the YouTube route for a little fame and fortune, and other people will say, well, "What about if I just write? Maybe if I just write a blog, maybe that will help me be rich and famous." Let's talk about blogging.
I don't like watching myself on video. I don't like being on video. I'm stretching myself a little bit to mm-hmm. do video a little bit more for some of my work projects.
Yeah.
And writing has always been more my thing. So if I'm going to be prone to try to find fame or fortune online, it's going to be through a blog. And so a while back, this week, I wrote a blog post called 3 Things a Blog Is Not. And really, this could apply to social media in general. But 3 Things a Blog Is Not. One, it's not your own little vehicle to fame and fortune. I've heard far too many stories of Christians starting blogs because they want to be famous among their peers or among others in Christianity, and or they want to make a lot of money. Usually these folks end up abandoning their blog within the first year or so because they realize it's not that easy. With one or two exceptions, my most successful blogger friends make at most a couple hundred dollars a month or a few hundred dollars a month. You know, they might try to pay for their kids' school, or maybe they'll save it up and go on vacation in a couple years or mm-hmm. something like that. Even my most quote unquote successful blogger friends, only a couple I know, one or two, are able to almost like make a living off of it. And that's because they've been doing it for a decade or more. Mm-hmm. And they're able to do it kind of as their job. But if you want to get rich and famous online, you're better off buying random stuff from Kohl's, like Chewbacca Mom, and going on Facebook Live and having a funny laugh. That's an easier way to get rich quick. But I think my view is that a Christian who blogs must do so as an act of service to the church and not as a means of trying to acquire fame and fortune.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be more servant-hearted. As second thing, quickly, that a blog is not – it's not an endeavor for the lazy or the lighthearted. You could – writing a blog, I say this from experience and because I've made plenty of mistakes where I deserved criticism, but other times where you could say I didn't deserve criticism, writing a blog opens you up to criticism. And so you can't be lighthearted. And if you know the myth of Sisyphus, the old story about the guy who was cursed to roll a rock up a hill for eternity, my opinion is that there's no effort so Sisyphean on the internet as blogging.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the school paper that's never done. It's the book that's never done. It's perpetual. And it's a lot of work. And then third and finally, it's not a place for you to drag people through the mud. Sometimes if you're writing a blog, there may be a time for you to call out a problem you see. I've had to do this a few times. If there's a problem you see in your genre, in your space, you might have to call it out. But there are too many what are called Christian watch blogs, in my opinion. There are too many blogs out there whose sole purpose is to criticize and try to call people out. And like I said, there are going to be times where you may feel the need to do that if you have some sort of online platform. But I think a blog should be a place for you to serve and encourage people more than a place for you to call people out in maybe an attempt to make yourself more well-known or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Chris, all interesting stuff. I appreciate the blog that you do because I read your blogs and they're very interesting, but I can understand the work it is to continually come up with fresh content and to be always producing, because that takes a lot of energy and work and concentration. And so I appreciate your work. You can go to where's the best way to reach you? Is it LifewaySocial.com or ChrisMartin.com?
Yeah, LifewaySocial.com is where I've been doing a lot of my writing. I still write some at MillennialEvangelical.com, and then Twitter is at ChrisMartin17.
Awesome. At ChrisMartin17. All right, Chris, we'll look forward to our next conversation. Have a great weekend. And
thanks.
Talk to you again soon. It's 4 minutes till the top of the hour. Let me take a short break, and then I'll wrap up the big show. Ooh, that's some river dancing right there. That's a lot of feet tapping at once in perfect unison. I've seen river dance 3 or 4 times. What a great show. Happy St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. And what a great opportunity to share our faith with others. If we get into the conversation about St. Patrick, a missionary from Rome that went to Ireland to share the faith that he had in Christ with others. And thanks to Chris Martin, and what a great second hour we had with Ryan T. Anderson and Bruce Ashford. Today is 3:16, so let me just leave with John 3:16. For God so loved the world, he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.